History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, this will be interesting because, believe it or not, you are the third guest I've had on the show to talk about Florida. The other two have not been as positive. The first one was a history of malaria, and Florida was basically a swamp until DDT came along, and you couldn't even get life insurance if you lived below a certain latitudinal line. The second discussion was about the collapse of the Florida housing bubble in the 1920s, which some think triggered the Great Depression. And nowadays, when you talk about Florida, it's usually headlines of Florida man survives alligator attack by poking it in the eyes, or Florida man buys Porsche with a check printed off from a printer. So Florida doesn't get a lot of positive news, but you are going to correct that a bit. So before we get into the chronology of the Florida colony, what first made you aware of it that made you want to research this topic and then eventually write a book about it?
Well, I've always been interested in Gulf Coast history. I've worked in several cultural institutions in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. And through those, working in various museums, other places, I was aware of the colonial story, but it had just been something I never really dove into until I moved down here to the Mobile area. And I just got really intrigued with that colonial story in more depth and began to learn of who controlled this area and when and why. And the more I got into it, the more intrigued I was, because especially for the British story here, people just are not familiar with it. There's very few standing, really no standing landmarks. There's a few historical markers and a statue or two, things like that. But for the most part, it was a chapter in the colonial story here that I found incredibly intriguing, but it was the one that we probably knew the least about. And there were no major books that had been written recently. And I just saw an opportunity. I said, this is sort of new history for a lot of people, and it was new to me. So I put it together, and I'm pleased to have ended up with a book that is probably more detailed than I originally even thought it might be. But I think it encapsulates that story nicely.
And it's interesting because before I heard of your book, I didn't even know that there was this colony. I remember taking geography classes in elementary and middle school, and you would see maps of the United States in different times, the colonial period, and then after the revolution, the antebellum period. And you would see the growth of states as territories become states out west. And there was always a lonely sliver of Spanish-controlled territory in Florida that shrinks and shrinks and shrinks until it eventually disappears. But I didn't know about a colony. So first, can you describe, when is this colony, British West Florida, set up in the United States, or North America, we should say, in relation to the other colonies that we do know more about?
Sure. Before I answer that, I will just second what you said about maps and things of the region. I found it really intriguing once I began to get into the topic and research it, that if you look at most of the histories of America that discuss this time period, most of the overview histories, they will generally show a map of the colonies and where British West Florida was. It's usually just labeled something like Spanish territory or something like that. It's just a very amorphous, undefined area in a surprising amount of books. But this colony, the colony of British West Florida, was founded. At the same time, the colony of British East Florida was founded, 1763, right at the end of the Seven Years' War, in which Britain defeated France, and France was forced to relinquish all its North American holdings, colonial holdings, and Britain took over those holdings. Now, At the same time, France had sort of ceded to its ally Spain some of its territory west of the Mississippi River. So Spain ends up controlling west of the Mississippi River, which was most of the colony of Louisiana. Britain gets all this territory in the Gulf, stretching from the Mississippi River all the way down the Florida Peninsula. They create two colonies out of it, with the dividing line being the Apalachicola River. So everything between the Mississippi and the Apalachicola was the colony of West Florida, with the capital at Pensacola. Everything on the other side, going all the way down the peninsula, was East Florida, with the capital at St. Augustine. So that's where they kind of come onto the scene in 1763.
Okay, so you're saying that Spanish had no holdings of what we know of as Florida today after 1763?
They, for a brief period, did not, because Spain was forced to relinquish that, just like the French lost the war, and they were allied with Spain. They were forced to relinquish their holdings. Well, Spain was forced to relinquish some of their territory in the agreement ending the war. And so some of that territory, glad you asked me about that, because I wasn't clear. Some of that territory was, of course, in the state, what is now the state of Florida. But what's interesting about West Florida, the colony they created, is it incorporated a little portion of what had been Spanish territory. You know, Pensacola was originally founded by the Spanish, and it was still a Spanish town at the end of that war when Britain took over. But the rest of the colony was also part of French holdings, because, you know, Mobile was founded by the French, had been a heart of that French colony of Louisiana for a long time. So West Florida occupied areas from both of the European nations that they took property from as a result of that war. And so they were establishing this colony. East Florida was almost entirely, well, it was entirely occupied by Spain at the end of the war. But West Florida had that unique mixture of being both a French and Spanish domains that they were taking over and establishing a new colony in that territory.
This sounds like a really interesting cultural mix, similar to Quebec. After the British take it over, they have a French-speaking population, so there's issues of conflicting identity and loyalty. What is this like in British West Florida when the British take over?
Well, it is a diverse mixture. You had in the Mobile area, you had primarily people who were French citizens, who were French speakers. And when the first commandant that comes to take over the fort at Mobile and establish British control of the region, he actually sends ahead of him an announcement written in French to say, look, there's been a change here, result of the war, we're taken over. And he gives them the opportunity to sign an oath of allegiance to Great Britain or move within a certain amount of months and settle their property, et cetera. Most of the French population actually ends up staying. They were not all that enamored of the idea of moving over to New Orleans, which, although had been a French town established by the French, and you would think there were some reasons they might want to go over there. Remember, France is leaving the scene and Spain's taking over. So they weren't quite sure they wanted to live under Spanish rule. So most of them ended up reluctantly, belatedly staying. Now, over in Pensacola and those regions, that was, of course, a Spanish colony. And it was a very small town, primarily military outpost. Well, when Spain evacuated its forces from there, any other civilians that were there were given the opportunity to leave with it, to go down to the colony they had in Mexico, and most everybody did. So you end up with the two primary settlements in this new colony that had existed at the time of its creation. One retained most of its population. It's not a huge town at the time. Mobile's just a few hundred people, but most of the people stayed. Over in Pensacola, just the opposite. Again, a small military outpost, few settlers around there, and most of them actually left. So in both cases, Britain is trying to establish a colony that, even though these communities have been here for several decades, neither was a very large place, and they were essentially creating a colony from scratch in a lot of ways, and that's the way they viewed it.
Mm-hmm. And you describe the creation of this colony is a halting attempt at instituting representative government. What is this new British colony like in its early years from the 1760s onward as they're trying to consolidate this very, very mixed population and build some sort of functioning government out of it?
Well, it is it's a place that causes a lot of frustration in a nutshell. They saw there were a lot of opportunities there because this colony, if you look at the geography, most of the major rivers that of course empty into the Gulf and the region come right through this area. And so they knew strategically that it could control those waterways and this interior section. They knew there were some opportunities there. Of course, there were Native American tribes they'd hope they could trade with. So they saw some opportunities in a developing region. On the other side of the coin, it seemed about as far removed from civilization as they knew it at the time. It was difficult to get goods and supplies and communication back and forth. And so they knew they were at a little bit of a disadvantage. And the climate was something they were unfamiliar with. Immigration came very, very slowly. People did come, but it was very slow. So it got off to a really slow start. And despite the best plans that they had, it really took a while for things to get going. And when they did, they were, as is the case in any developing area, when you've got these new government establishments, they didn't always get along. People had competing visions, competing interests. And so there was anything but harmony in the leadership. And that was just another thing that slowed the growth of the colony. But in a nutshell, I'd say it was a slow developing colony that some people at sometimes questioned if it was all worth it. Others saw that there was great potential in the future if they could stay the course.
When a colony first sets up, or when one state conquers another state, there's this period usually of consolidation where it's not as if the only power holders are the really members of the government, but sometimes you have to deal with the pre-existent power holders, whether that's an Indian tribe, whether that's somebody who is important in the Spanish colony or French colony, a powerful merchant, something like that. Who are these different sort of power brokers that are the hubs of power in the early years of this colony?
Well, the original power brokers were, of course, the Native American tribes that controlled most of that, well, all of the interior of the colony. They did not have their major settlements right there on the coast, so it was sort of an easy transition for them in some ways to deal with the Native Americans in those particular areas, because they're taking over these small towns that had been there for a long time. That was not so much what was new as the trading relationship. So they were, for the first time, they were stepping into a situation where they were vastly outnumbered by the Creeks and the Choctaws, who had been working in various capacities with the French and the Spanish over the years, and had always been told for decades that Great Britain's the mortal enemy of France. And so the first thing they know is there's a war that's occurred. Their ally, or sometimes ally, I should say, France had lost, and the colony is being handed over to what they presumed were the mortal enemies, or had been told that. Of course, you know, I'm simplifying things, because the Creeks had attempted to trade with the British and all before. They were not naive of all this, but they were wondering what was going to be next. And so the first and the paramount and sort of the enduring foreign relations concern for the colony ended up being relationships with the Native Americans and those trade alliances, and trying to make it an alliance where everybody's happy. You've got to remember, it's all based on trade. And if traders don't behave or can't supply the goods that the Native Americans want, then that's just not an economic risk. That could potentially be a military risk and a political risk. And so that ends up occupying a lot of their time, trying to regulate that trade, formalize it, secure some monopolies on trade with Native American groups. And really, in the overview, they were moderately successful in that. It was not a complete success, but was not a complete failure. There was some concern in the early years of the colony that there were some tensions between the British settlers and some of the, especially the Creek that were living nearby. And there was some concern that that military action might actually come to military action to secure the colony. It didn't. But the fact that it didn't, when at a time when the Choctaws and the Creeks outnumbered these settlers, roughly 5,000 British settlers in this colony in the 1760s, and the Choctaws and the Creeks combined population would have been approaching 40, 50,000 people. You can see the disparity there and the fact that there were no major conflicts that really set back the colony or really endangered it showed that they were somewhat successful in establishing those relationships despite a rocky start.
Well, if we're talking about tensions, we always have to talk about money. Of what is the money at stake? Where does it come from? And how do people fight over it? And at this period in colonial history, the wealth in the Caribbean comes from sugarcane, and this is probably the wealthiest part of the British colonies, and where much of the action of the Seven Years' War and even the Revolutionary War from the French and British sides are taking place. Up further north in Virginia, tobacco is the main cash crop, and then further north in the New England colonies, fishing, timber, other things like that. This area in the British Florida, what is the main production of wealth? What is being created? What's being farmed? And how is it being shipped? Is it being sent on the Atlantic and the Gulf or some other way?
Well, they tried several things. They tried tobacco. They could not produce the quantity or the quality that was being produced in the Chesapeake. And they had, of course, the logistical concerns of getting it to the markets. And all of these crops are relying on maritime trade with other British holdings in the Caribbean and, of course, other colonies, colonies in North America. They tried indigo, which was, you're not familiar with indigo. It's not just the color, but it was a dye produced from the indigo plant. Complicated a production procedure, required a lot of investment, a lot of skill, and, of course, you had to have a ready market for it, and there was a lot of competition throughout the globe for this market. So that worked for some people, but only moderately. And a lot of food crops are growing corn, chickpeas, all these types of things, and for local trade. Herding cattle and hogs is a local business that's supplying the major communities. People around there are relying on that as a part of their income because there was a ready market for it. On some scale, the one thing that was easiest to get into, and probably most consistently produced results, although they were not spectacular, was the lumber business. The whole Gulf Coast was especially at that point, we've forgotten just how much of it this area was covered with longleaf pine at one point, which was a native pine species that a lot of people refer to as heart pine and things like that. It's that strong, durable, longleaf old growth pine that we have systematically sort of destroyed it from the ecosystem in a lot of the Southeast. But at that point in time, it was just ripe for the picking. And it is this beautiful, rot resistant, very straight, durable wood. And it was used to build everything from barrels and homes to ships and ship mast. And you could also produce make the byproducts from the pine trees, such as pitch and tar that were used in caulking up naval ships, et cetera. That was probably the easiest and most widespread stable enterprise that people engaged in. But none of these were just spectacular runaway successes. This was not a place that had this thriving plantation economy just yet. That would come later. That would come after cotton gins and things like that. But the seeds were sown in this area of British control.
Was it because it was far off the well-traveled sea routes that made Florida hard, or was it the environment? Because when I read accounts of Florida, it sounds like in some ways what British missionaries in the 19th century would describe Africa as, the white man's grave, where you go there, you get malaria, and you die. And you know, like I said, I want to bring a positive shine to Florida a little more in this episode after my malaria episode. So was it really, a struggle to survive there, or was it not that much different from any other part of the colonial South? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Well, at first, I have to say it probably was a little bit more of a struggle than they anticipated. And then once they understood the area a little bit better, they, of course, got more acclimated to it. And they began to settle in other parts that were a little bit more hospitable. The things that they were more familiar with, like the Mississippi Valley, as they expanded, when the first true, really wave of immigration that came to the colony actually was over on the Mississippi Valley near Natchez. But when they first arrived at those colonial outposts that are right there on the waterways of Mobile Bay, Pensacola Bay, right there at the Gulf, they were encountering areas that were not incredibly productive as far as agriculture, that relied on trade from other regions. And they were low and swampy and hot and humid. And the first people that arrived, a lot of these first troops had no exposure, no understanding of the climate at all. So you've got all these things like mosquitoes and yellow fever and all these various diseases that spread very quickly in that sort of environment. And that really just devastated some of the first garrisons that were there. So very early in its history, it acquired a reputation as a very sickly place. There's one gentleman who came there that described the whole colony, he said, is nothing but a graveyard for Britons. So I know that's not the positive spin. It's very much like what you just got with the malaria story. But that was the first impression among several people. But over time, they learned how to adapt. They learned that in the heat of the summer in Mobile, rather than confining the men in these sickly fortifications right there near the waterways, perhaps you could post them on the eastern shore of Mobile Bay. It's got some better water supplies, elevated, catch a breeze, things like that, that they adapted. And some of those original descriptions were a little bit harsh because a lot of people at first that came down here thought of themselves at the very far edges of civilization. And they had sort of a vested interest in saying, this probably is not going to be worth it. But after a while, they did understand a little bit better how to adapt here. And in the end, it ended up being not all that much different than the experience in any other area. But it was a rough beginning.
Do you think there are any unique characteristics of British Florida that set it apart from other colonies at this time? And are there any interesting people that emerge during this colonial period?
Well, overall, as far as the general lifestyle, really, it's not all that much different. It's a British colony. And the travelers that come through, they remark on the flora and the fauna, the natural environment is what makes it unique, not necessarily the lifestyle. So I do think there is a uniqueness to it, and that uniqueness is simply the geography. Trying to establish a Gulf Coast colony, different requirements in the landscape that was here than in other places. But as far as people's expectations and the way they lived, they were very much British. And other ethnic groups that migrated in, just as they were in other colonies. The difference was the landscape in which you're trying to make a living. There were some very interesting characters that come to light. The leadership, probably one of the most iconic folks to study about that's associated with colonies, is its first appointed governor, George Johnstone, who is sent here. He's this sort of, I hate to use the word arrogant, he's definitely self-assured, and he has a definite vision for what the colony could be. And he's sort of a divisive figure, though. A lot of the things that he proposed were things that following governors pursued. There were common sense things. They want to establish trade with the regional colonies, and he really pushed trying to establish trade with Louisiana, even though that was technically forbidden. You're supposed to trade within the British Empire. And he pointed out, well, this is not a place where we're surrounded by obvious trading partners. He wanted to establish a good relationship with the Native Americans. He had some problems with that. He saw immediately that the colony, if it was going to survive and prosper, being a, with all those rivers that flow through the area, he saw those as also potential invasion routes for anybody who wanted to come into the colony one day, and said, we need to take some efforts to fortify this place And we need to establish a strong government. All these are things that are pretty much common sense in some ways, but took a strong leader to develop. And he had some limited success in kind of laying the foundation for all of British West Florida. He's really creating colony from scratch in some ways, as I said before. And he really puts the foundation together. The problem was he really couldn't get along with anybody that didn't agree with him, or he felt he had to have such control because of the circumstances that this was not the place or time for a lot of debates about direction. He came from a naval background, the captain of the ship, his way has to go. And he governed like that and ended up being a very divisive personality. But the stories of the ways that unfolded are sometimes humorous. There was one occasion where he was locked out of his own quarters at the Fort of Pensacola and was forced to scale the wall to get back into his own quarters. And there was an observer who said at this point, it was not hard to tell the general opinion of the governor. So he is a guy that a lot of people did not like, but I think he's very interesting. He was certainly very capable. And a lot of West Florida's development traces back to his tenure in office.
Was anything happening during the Revolutionary War in the Florida colony? Because I did a whole military history series on the Revolutionary War, and I don't remember anything from it, which isn't to say it didn't happen. That could be due to historiographical reasons. Maybe the skirmishes were too small to appear on the radar of big military histories. But whether there were or weren't battles, what was happening there during the Revolutionary War?
Well, there were some interesting military campaigns. I'll go through those for you in a second. But as far as what was happening general among the population, is that this place was actually, the colony was actually invited to participate in the Continental Congress. The general reaction of most of the civilians that were in the colony was not one of fierce loyalism. Sometimes it's labeled as a loyal colony because it did not actively rebel. But it was not necessarily that they were fiercely loyal and opposed to the things that were taking place elsewhere, as much as they felt detached from them. They were very much fighting for survival, as I've just explained. It's a colony that's really wide with some very remote stretches. You don't have major population centers where people are just clustered together to discuss current events. There are no newspapers being published in the colony. News takes a long time to get into the colony from what's happening in the Northeast. So there's a lot of mitigating circumstance that make them feel that what's taking place, the rebellion that's beginning to take place in the seaboard colonies, is sort of someone else's fight, somebody else's problem in some ways. And you can't discount the fact that this is a relatively small population and probably a larger percentage of the colony's population than in some other places are in the direct employment of the British government, either soldiers or officials. So that there's some circumstances that make a lot of these, the colonists here, not actively engaged in some of these discussions. Now, ultimately, the war does find the colony, and really two significant campaigns, one a lot larger than the other. One, you've got the campaign of James Willing, who is an American that's authorized by the Continental Congress to head down the Mississippi River. And it's his job to secure the neutrality of the region, as he described it, and to open up a line of communication with the Spanish in New Orleans, who are sympathetic to the American cause and already supplying the Americans with arms and ammunition during the war. What his official authorization was and what he actually did may be slightly different. We still don't know all that he thought it was within his purview, but what he ultimately did was to go down the Mississippi River, secure the neutrality of Natchez, raise the American flag, and proceed on a campaign of just sheer plunder throughout the region with the apparent purpose of selling all the goods that he plundered and stole at New Orleans, because he knew the Spanish were friendly to the United States. Now, that's sort of the overview of the campaign. It's not a major military campaign, but definitely awoke the British to the fact that their colony lay relatively open for an invasion, because all this had happened almost before they really got word of what was happening in Pensacola. So it exposed that. The major military campaign, though, the one that really had a lasting influence on the colony, because it ended up resulting in the transfer of the colony from British control to Spanish, were the campaigns of Bernardo de Galvez, the governor of Louisiana. Tensions were rising between Great Britain and Spain during this time. France had already allied itself with the United States in the Revolutionary War. It was doing its best to bring its ally Spain into the war against Great Britain. Spain ultimately declared war on Great Britain. They were very careful not to be a formal ally of the United States, although they did send arms and material covertly. But Galvez was aware of what was happening here nationally. He knew his neighboring colony was controlled by a foreign power, which his mother country was at war, and which controlled territory that his country had just lost a decade or two earlier, and they wanted back. They wanted Florida back. So he laid a plan for a surprise attack as soon as war would be declared, and it was in the summer of 1779. And he, on a lightning campaign along the Mississippi River, captures three strategic British military outposts in West Florida very quickly. And almost before the news can get back to Pensacola, the whole half of the colony is now under British, effectively under Spanish control. And then after that, Galvez would initiate two other campaigns. The second one goes specifically to capture the town of Mobile. He lays siege to Mobile, captures it after a brief siege in 1780. Then the British, as he's resupplying to make a final campaign to capture the capital of Pensacola, the British launched their one attack of the campaign by attacking a place called The Village, which was right close to where I'm sitting here in Spanish Fort, Alabama. It was between Daphne and Spanish Fort on the Eastern Shore. There's a significant military engagement there in 1781, which the British were repulsed. And they immediately, after that, gather all their forces and just launch right into a major campaign to take Pensacola. It results in the longest siege of the Revolutionary War and the largest battle to this day that was fought in the state of Florida. And at the end of it, the Spanish captured Pensacola and effectively took over the colony through military force.
One short little tangent before we get back to this. You mentioned that in the British Florida, there weren't major population centers. Most of those who were employed by the British government. I imagine looking at sources, is it almost all British government documentation? Because I'm guessing there's not pamphleteers the way you would have in Philadelphia in this time, or newspapers or all that.
And that's a good point. I referenced that in the book. Most of what you have is official government correspondence. And within that government correspondence and a few private letters that I found, there is obvious mention that some of the things that are taking place in other American colonies are at least discussed on some level. Even George Johnstone makes reference to the fact that in the debate over the Stamp Act, which was going on in the mid-1760s, he said that something to the effect of what they call liberty, those ideas are beginning to be discussed here, what they meaning other colonies on the seaboard. But remember, there's no newspaper, there's no evidence I found whatsoever of any sort of organized group like the Sons of Liberty and other groups that were debating the type of things that were going on in, say, Boston or Charleston. And so what you have are observers that give you a hint that there is some level of discussion on the street, but there's certainly no indication that it's sort of a widespread general involvement in what we call this revolutionary rebellion that's beginning to take shape in the 1770s. Again, it goes back to the fact that it's at least my assumption from everything that I've gathered that it's less ideological, although there's certain ideological component. It's more geographical and situational, and they feel as far removed from what's taking place in another colony as you can be. And we're so focused on just trying to scratch out a living that it didn't seem like it was their fight until suddenly the Spanish were on their back door. And although that was not an American campaign, that was definitely a part of the whole Revolutionary War, because Spain was attacking specifically because they knew Great Britain was vulnerable and very preoccupied with a major rebellion elsewhere.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
What happens after the transfer of power from Britain to Spain?
This whole area becomes now, instead of British West Florida, it's Spanish West Florida. And one of the interesting political debates that plays into both Alabama and Mississippi's history right after that is a part of that, because going all the way back to the beginning of the colony of British West Florida, the treaty ending the Seven Years' War has specifically indicated the 31st parallel as the border, the northern border of this new colony. And that northern border basically is just north of Mobile, Alabama, if you can picture that in your mind. And once George Johnstone got on the ground and realized that the true extent of the territory, had a look at it, he and others realized that there's a huge interior of rich land with major waterways just to their north. There was really nothing stopping them from expanding those back boundaries northward. And so he petitioned the authorities in London to do so. He wanted the colony to move northward all the way up to almost to where the Tennessee line was. They decided to make the northern boundary at the 32nd parallel, basically where the Yazoo River meets the Mississippi, roughly Vicksburg, Mississippi. If you draw a line from Vicksburg, draw it eastward, you'd go through Jackson, Mississippi, Montgomery, Alabama, and on to Columbus, Georgia. So that becomes the boundary of British West Florida that they maintain throughout their tenure. Well, when Spain takes over the colony, they claim the same territory. The sticking point was that in the Treaty of Paris, ending the war, recognizing these new boundaries, they made reference to that 1763 boundary, which was the 31st parallel. So Spain saying, well, we occupy this because Great Britain did. United States says, well, that was never, we're not going to recognize that as a boundary, that we're going to go by the 1763 boundary. That becomes a sticking point in international negotiations. That's not a major front burner issue for a few years, but it's a festering issue that's finally resolved with the Treaty of San Lorenzo in 1795, when the Spanish are eventually forced to evacuate north of the 31st parallel a few years after that. United States immediately annexes all that territory between the northern boundary of British West Florida and the 31st parallel. They annex it into a new territory. They name the Mississippi Territory. So that's the beginnings of the states of Alabama and Mississippi. So that's how I'm bringing the full story from the colonial all the way up to the statehood era.
Well, I think a big question for this book is, what do you think is gained if we understand the story of the 14th colony, which is the name of your book, and we bring it back into the narrative of the colonial period in America? Why do you think it's important to understand it to get a fuller picture?
First and foremost, because we have forgotten, or maybe we never really realized, that there was an America beyond the Atlantic coast during this time period. We are focused, and rightly so, on what was happening in the 13 colonies, but we've forgotten the true scope and scale of the British Empire. We've forgotten that the Gulf Coast and the states of Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, Louisiana, all have a revolutionary era heritage. And it's different than some of the stories from the founding fathers, but it's no less significant to our region. It had great impact on the development of this area, and it did have an indirect impact in the course of the Revolutionary War. And it was it's just a story that I think that we should reclaim, rather than just dismissing it as an inconsequential outside area, because it was very much part and parcel of the British Empire at the time.
Well, and one more question to tie these things in together. What do you think are those overlooked effects that the Florida colony had on the region and the United States in general that you try to highlight?
Well, it's one of the primary ones would be simply the development of the Gulf Coast, which we know today is a very different place than it was at one time. We know it as a rather dynamic population center that's thriving and growing. And its roots, Mobile, Pensacola, Baton Rouge, Natchez, all these areas and more in the whole Mississippi Gulf Coast, some of those areas had been claimed by the French for a long time. It was really during the British period that they really began to be settled. A lot of their formational time periods go back to this. And, it began a process of a contested borderland that this area became that would be a major component of American foreign relations throughout the rest of the 1700s, well into the early 1800s, until the Spanish finally cede the last portions of Florida all the way in 1819. So this is a beginning of a debate that's going to ultimately involve the creation of new American territories. It's going to involve a small-scale rebellion that we'll have time to discuss in West Florida. It's going to involve treaties, and it's going to involve military conquest during the War of 1812. It's going to involve Andrew Jackson invading foreign territory. And it's going to involve even debates over the extent of the wording of the territory in the Louisiana Purchase. So this region becomes a focal point for U.S. diplomacy for several decades, and how it got there is all rooted in this time period. So that's another one of the many ways. But as I said, it all goes back to the fact that I think if we have a fuller understanding of the broad everything that was happening in North America at the time, we'll get a better understanding of the context of the Revolutionary War and America's development and why this area ultimately became American. So it's just trying to put the pieces of the puzzle all together.
It shows too that the beginnings of the United States are much more mixed than we give credit for. It's not just British immigration and then some French people down in New Orleans, but already much more diverse and mixed than that at a very early date. Well, So for those who want to dive into the story more, the name of the book is The 14th Colony, The Forgotten Story of the Gulf South During America's Revolutionary Era. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I think that covers it. That's all I have for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraza, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.